This is Morgan Beatty speaking from the House of Representatives in Washington. I'll be back in a moment with news of the day.
You've heard a lot of talk about sharing your car, about carpooling. Well, now, carpooling doesn't mean thumbing a ride or casual picking up of people waiting for buses and streetcars. The sharing that really counts is the organized carpool, where the members rotate the use of cars, ride together, and leave at home cars that would otherwise be in use. Well, now, here's an example of how it works. Five men are going to work, each in his own car. So the workers form a carpool, and four cars are left home every day. You see, carpooling saves cars, tires, and gasoline. It offers the best solution to the problem of war shortages. And now from Washington, here is Morgan Beatty.
General Eisenhower has launched his counter-blow at the German bulge on the Western Front. Dispatches from the Third Army report that General George Patton has hurled a many-headed armored attack against the German positions around Bastogne. The American armor has gained up to a mile and a half on the eastern side of the Bastogne corridor. West of the town, infantry and armor in combination have edged ahead a similar distance, about a mile and a half. The front dispatch indicates that General Patton is still building up the base for an intensive assault, an attempt to pinch off the Germans in the bulge. He has not yet lashed out with all his strength. First, he's ensuring his army against German cutoff attempts later on. The Germans themselves report today that eight American divisions, upwards of 110,000 men, have been hurled into action in an attempt to encircle and trap Nazi positions on both sides of the town of Bastogne. The enemy, says the German official communique, gained but minor ground. Dispatches from the Third Army front, Allied dispatches, tend to confirm the German estimate of the situation as of yesterday. Lou Hawkins, a frontline reporter with the Third Army, gives us this advice. He says the Germans are fighting a sly, fluid, withdrawing action on the southern flank. Apparently, he adds, they're trying to win enough time for the retreat of their forces to the north and west. This sly, cautious, defensive kind of fighting, says Hawkins, began on New Year's Eve. For example, the enemy would pull out of a village near Bastogne and let the American forces enter unopposed. Then they would filter back to land sneak punches during the night. They are making extensive use of mines, booby traps, and well-concealed roadblocks. Meanwhile, the German attacks on the southern end of the battle line, the main line, in the Saar Basin continue, and the enemy has made gains up to a mile or 2 miles in places. But at Allied headquarters, these attacks are still regarded as feelers. They have not yet assumed the proportions of true offensive action. Rather, they are diversionary. More evidence that General Eisenhower is striking back in Belgium with confidence in the result is the fact that the news blackout on the Battle of the Belgian Bulge has been revised downward again. The time lag is now only 24 hours behind battle action. At first, you may remember, the blackout was complete. Then, a 48-hour battle lag was ordered. Last week, this was reduced to 36 hours, and now, a delay of only 24 hours, the normal lag, has been set up in news from the battle line. And the Germans issued today a summary of what they regard as their accomplishments during the counteroffensive in the West. They report that American forces have suffered 50,000 casualties or more since December the 16th. They say they've taken 24,000 prisoners, which would indicate the American dead and wounded, by official German estimate, stand at about 26,000 men. The Germans also claim that they captured 400 guns and 1,230 tanks and armored vehicles. In the past, German official communiques have been, on the whole, fairly reliable. So, in the absence of any Allied reports on our casualties in the West, we may assume the German claims are somewhere in the neighborhood of the facts. We'll know as soon as General Eisenhower decides to release the facts. But the enemy is summarizing his accomplishments in Belgium. That is a sure sign of another fact. Not only has he done his worst or best, but he has admitted the loss of the initiative. It's back in American hands. Meanwhile, our airmen are coming in with new reports of damage in the air over the Third Army front in the Bastogne area. A battle dispatch says German weather luck turned against von Rundstedt on December the 27th and gave our forces 5 straight days of clear skies. The 19th Tactical Air Command says this presented our supporting air power an opening for a series of attacks, vicious attacks. Attacks that cost the enemy 1,900 motor transports and 226 tanks and armored vehicles. The 19th claims it has done much to break the back of the German offensive in the Bulge. Meanwhile, today, 1,100 American strategic bombers smashed rail and transport centers in western Germany for the 12th consecutive day. The aerial offensive continues unabated. But now that conditions are improving in the West, there's no point in blinking the fact that we took a very heavy blow. The American soldier did take a whale of a beating in the last 2 weeks of the old year, but he also surprised the Germans, surprised them more than they've been surprised in a long time. You see, well, we have a story today from Kenneth Dixon, another frontline reporter. The Germans, the British, and others have always said that the Yanks were good soldiers, but they always added, he didn't get mad enough, he didn't attack with ruthless determination, and he didn't have the stubbornness characteristic of the British Tommy through centuries of defensive fighting. Well, says Kenneth Dixon, they aren't saying that anymore around the fringe of the battle line in Belgium. Dixon has the division general's word for it. Sure, I did a good job, says the general. I stopped the enemy. But if I had done 10 times better, I still would not have been worthy of those American kids out there. Why, one company I know, he added, would beat back and attack, a German attack, then shift while the German outfit was resting up and beat off another attack. Then they'd shift back again in time to be in there to beat back the first bunch of Boche all over again. By everything in the book, said the general, those soldiers of mine couldn't have done it. But they did do it. I still can't understand it. Perhaps a captain expresses himself a little more freely, a little more clearly. Soda jerks, American soda jerks and grocery clerks, he snorts. Look at them, pimply-faced mother's boy, scared school kids, not a military man among them. And it took this German offensive, he adds, to prove that those men are the best darn fighting men in the world. They saved the American army, those softy civilian soldiers. This civilian soldier of ours should have panicked, says the captain, but he didn't panic. He was mad at nobody, but he got mad. Those kids of mine, he concluded, aren't the same soldiers they were last fall. Something's happened to them. I can't understand it either. Well, maybe the captain doesn't understand it, but a fellow with a field marshal's cap on the other side of the battle line understands it, and he understands it well. A fellow named von Rundstedt. He was badly fooled, thank heaven, by the American civilian soldier. And now, a news bulletin from the other side of the world, the Pacific. It's dated Super Fortress Headquarters, Guam. America's Super Fortress offensive against Japan entered a new phase today. A sizable force of B-29s directed for the first time from Guam rained bombs on industrial Japan. Now your announcer. I'll be back in exactly 60 seconds.
Don't say it. Stop careless talk. Of course, it's only natural for people to want to talk about the war. And we know that people will talk unless they're convinced that their information may be of value to the enemy. This is why the security of war information must be the daily concern of every American. Any fragment of war information, no matter how harmless it seems, may be of value to the enemy. Placed in with other facts already known, it may reveal ship sailings or attack plans. Such careless talk could lead to sudden death for thousands of American fighting men. If we must talk about the war, let's follow these rules. If we hear it from someone, don't repeat it. If you see it yourself, don't repeat it. But if you read it in the newspapers or magazines, or hear it on the radio, then the facts have been officially released. And then and only then are we free to talk about them as we wish. Join the fight to stop careless talk. Once again, here is Morgan Beatty.
Today, the 79th Congress convened a few feet away from the radio gallery here in the House of Representatives where this program is being given today. A few moments ago, they re-elected Sam Rayburn of Texas, Speaker of the House, amid great applause from all the assembled members. This Congress is assembling to tackle the problems of our leanest war year, severe problems they are. And just as it met, the White House sent a directive to Selective Service in order to proceed to the fullest extent of the law to draft farm workers between 18 and 25 years old. War mobilizer James F. Burns, acting under the direct authority of the President and against the advice of the War Food Administration, says there are 364,000 men in this class under 26 years old, and more of them ought to be inducted into the services. The President feels, in view of existing conditions, he adds, that agriculture, like other war industries, can, with few exceptions, be carried on by those in the older age groups. Incidentally, it's sometimes a little odd to note that our allies do not understand the extent of American participation in this war even yet. They have for some years felt that the United States, because it has not actually been drawn into the cauldron of destruction, has not been too active or as active as they are. For example, on the day that the last of our manpower on the farm is tapped for fighting purposes, the manpower that made possible tremendous shipments of food to Britain and Russia and other allies, on this day, here's what the British press is saying as Congress reconvenes. The correspondent for Lord Beaverbrook's Daily Express, writing from Washington, says Congress is opening a vital session. During it, he adds, that age-old question, isolationism or not, must be settled. In other words, a showdown in Congress is approaching. Let us not pretend, he warns his British readers, that this issue is settled. After the election, it looked as if it were, he added, but we were wrong. A similar view is expressed by the London Times. Isolation in its manifold guises, says the Times, remains a living force in American political thought. Events in Poland, Italy, and Greece, adds the Times, have provided plain examples of practical embarrassments which may be involved. American censure, the Times goes on, untempered by American proposals for constructive action, encourages belief on this side of the Atlantic in an ingrained American unwillingness to accept political responsibilities in Europe. All of this comes on the day that the American Middle West, so long labeled isolationist, is asked to contribute another large quota of farm workers to the armed forces. All of this without a single word about the present military objective in Europe, a city named Berlin. Sometimes our European friends seem almost as dense as we are supposed to be in sophisticated circles. But the military men who have their orders to take Berlin, not Athens and Budapest, see the thing differently. Here's Marshal Montgomery's New Year's message to General Eisenhower on the Western Front. I want to assure you, it says, of the personal devotion and loyalty of myself and all those under my command. We will, said the British Marshal, follow you anywhere. It takes a wise British subject to make a statement like that to an American commander. And down in New Orleans today, Dennis Kendall, a member of the British Parliament on his way back to England, says that Prime Minister Churchill's Tory policies, as he calls them, toward smaller European countries, carried through without consultation with the United States, are in high disfavor in England. And President Roosevelt reminds us that we might as well expect differences among the Allies throughout the war. In his press radio conference just ahead of the congressional session opening today, the President hinted that the differences are not in principle, but in the ways or methods that must be taken to reestablish European order and European states. And these differences, in his opinion, are not at all insoluble. They're things that just must be lived with. Perhaps we can take a hint of what to expect from our own new Congress. American representative government has never offered us or the world any pretty picture of a smooth sail on a smooth mill pond. Not a bit of it. And the storm signals are flying on Capitol Hill again today, even if you can't see them clearly in the expressions of goodwill on opening day. The Senate, for example, expects a debate on foreign affairs to break out next Monday or Tuesday, and there's going to be some kind of a battle over the president's war powers this year. Mr. Roosevelt wants the War Labor Board to have congressional authority for its rulings. Congress says the board already has authority enough. At least some members are thinking that way. In other words, Congress has agreed today that the war is far from won, but there is no agreement yet on ways and means to reinforce the home front for the bitter fighting and the production task ahead. There are going to be many differences, and you and I will live with those differences and get used to them, and we'll make progress through them. But today, all is goodwill at the opening. This morning, Senator-elect Glenn H. Taylor of Idaho gathered his family about him on the steps of the Capitol, strummed a chord on his banjo, and sang a song for the benefit of the newsreels and the news cameramen. Oh, give me a home, he sang, near the Capitol dome, with a yard where little children can play. Just a room or two, any old thing will do. Oh, we can't find a place to stay. The senator, like many another congressman, is having trouble with the housing shortage in Washington. That's all for now, and thank you. I'll be back at this same time tomorrow.
Would you be interested in discovering a way to increase the life of your car 80% or more? Well, I guess there's not a car owner who wouldn't answer a vehement yes to that question. Well, now our government offers a very simple plan, and the plan is to form a carpool. Yes, it's as easy as that. You see, the idea is to make an agreement with four or five of your friends so that you all go to work in one car. That way, each car is used only once in every 4 or 5 days. You save on gas, you save your tires, and in general, on the whole life of your car. So why don't you talk it over with your friends today? A carpool is the solution to the gas and tire problem. Morgan Beatty is heard Monday through Friday. Today, he was heard from the radio gallery of the House of Representatives. Tomorrow at the same time, keep up with the news with Morgan Beatty. This is the National Broadcasting Company.